Talking history. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the Battle for Cork in the summer of 1922 and how it changed the course of the Civil War. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text 53106 and text cost 30 cents, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. In recent weeks, we've discussed the attempts to put the Kaiser on trial in 1918, the burning of Cork, and the Irish mathematician who may have been the inspiration for Professor Moriarty. And we also had a full show on the life and poetry of Emily Dickinson. So if you want to listen back to any of these shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. Now, every year we visit one of our great cities and towns across the country for an outside broadcast. And this year in June, we are going to be heading to one of the most beautiful cities in the entire country. And it's a history that includes the Normans, the first witch trial in Ireland, and the Statutes of Kilkenny. I've given it away there. We are going to be live from the Langton House Hotel in Kilkenny on Sunday, the 9th of June. And we're going to be joined by a panel of historians, writers and archaeologists to explore one of Ireland's greatest cities. So we'd love you to join us. We always have great fun. Just go to the website newstalk.com/events. Tickets are free, but it's as always first come, first served. So we'd love to see you in the Langton House Hotel in Kilkenny on Sunday the 9th of June. So get your tickets now. newstalk.com/events. In tonight's show, we're debating the Battle for Cork. Taking place in July and August 1922, the Battle for Cork was the largest engagement of the Irish Civil War, an assault by the National Army against what the Irish Times called the capital of insurrection. General Emmet Dalton and a National Army group landed at Passage West in a daring amphibious assault in what has been described by the historian John Borgonovo as one of the most famous surprise attacks in Irish military history. They succeeded in knocking back the Cork IRA, and after days of fighting, the city was secured. Soon after, Michael Collins made his final fateful visit to Cork. In tonight's show, we want to explore what really happened during the Battle for Cork and debate its significance in the context of the Civil War and Irish history. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Brian Hughes lectures in the Department of History at Mary Immaculate College, the University of Limerick, and his books include Defying the IRA, Intimidation, Coercion and Communities During the Irish Revolution. Sean Boyne is a writer, historian and journalist, and is the author of Emmet Dalton, Psalm Soldier, Irish General, Film Pioneer. Dr. John Borgonovo lectures in the School of History at UCC, where he was involved in the hugely successful Atlas of the Irish Revolution, and he's the author of The Battle for Cork, July to August 1922. Well, you're all very welcome. And John, I'll begin with you, as you're the author of the book on the Battle for Cork. Can you maybe give our listeners some of the context? What was happening in Ireland in the lead up to the Battle for Cork? What was happening in terms of the Civil War?
So we normally kind of divide the Civil War into two phases, a conventional phase that lasted about 6 or 7 weeks, and then a guerrilla phase that lasted, you know, 8 or 9 months. So the first, you know, roughly 6-7 weeks of the Civil War, you had two opposing military forces, the National Army, the pro-treaty folks representing the Irish Free State, and they were fighting the anti-treaty IRA. And the anti-treaty forces controlled a lot of the country, much of Connacht, and pretty much all of Munster, with one or two exceptions. And so over the course, after the battle, the four courts, the Battle of Dublin, the National Army left, we kind of moved out of Dublin and proceeded to capture towns and cities across the rest of the Irish Free State. The most severe test for that campaign was in Munster. You had pretty strong encounters in Limerick City. There was pretty frequent fighting along a rough line from Waterford to Limerick, and that continued for a couple weeks. And, you know, you had hundreds of troops involved on both sides. You had artillery from the Free State side. You had, armored cars. And it was pretty severe and pretty intense, at least for the scale of Irish warfare at that time. And then it was basically the IRA's control of the province then kind of was under severe assault and by the end of July, early August, and then kind of the breaking point, the tipping point, was a series of amphibious assaults by the National Army, first in Kerry near Tralee, and then kind of three simultaneous ones in County Cork, including the one in the lower harbour of Cork City at Passage West.
And why was Munster such a Republican stronghold during the Civil War? What was driving the IRA in Munster to oppose the treaty and to fight so vehemently?
Well, I think that we forget that the IRA wasn't necessarily a strictly hierarchical organization. It was quite decentralized. IRA units kind of armed themselves, they financed themselves, they fought without really any direct, with very limited direction from Dublin, and they were being kind of dictated peace terms that they had very limited insight into and contributions towards. So they weren't really involved in the decision to sign the Anglo-Irish Treaty. And once it was kind of presented to them as a fait accompli, they felt that they had limited options except to militarily oppose the imposition, the creation of the Irish Free State, and kind of defending their self-declared republic. And keep in mind that these Munster IRA units were among the strongest in the country, the best armed, and also the best organized. So they offered a pretty severe test of the new fledgling Free State government.
And although Michael Collins was from Cork, he actually was quite strong in his language about the resistance. And he gave a newspaper interview where he really had quite trenchant language.
Yeah, I mean, one thing, Collins is obviously of Cork and from Cork, but he hadn't spent really much of any time here since he had left as a young man, as a teenager, and gone to London. So he didn't really have anything to do with the IRA in County Cork. And he had emerged as this political leader, largely first from his base in London, but then also in Dublin. And so there was kind of a lot of regional differences as well. And Cork was kind of the center gravity in the fiercest kind of IRA units in the War of Independence, and they also led kind of the resistance to the new Free State in the situation leading up to the outbreak of the Civil War.
And do you think he was serious when he threatened that he would burn Cork to the ground? Was he serious?
Oh, yeah. they attacked the forecourts. Collins kind of was talking about the necessity of having to burn Cork in order to protect the new state and the new government and his vision of an independent Ireland or a semi-independent Ireland, and he was willing to do what he needed to do to accomplish that, and he was pretty decisive, and that was also a key difference in his leadership. He was quite decisive. He was willing to not just risk a civil war, but to really pursue a civil war in order to make sure that the new Free State Constitution would have legs and would last. And it was that willingness to kind of initiate hostilities and sustain hostilities that really, was the difference between the two sides in the success of the civil war, amongst many other things. But that was definitely a key factor.
Sean, there was, of course, a general election in Ireland in June 1922. And did that play into the fighting then as well, given the results?
Yeah, there was an election following a pact between the two sides, and the result was a landslide vote against the anti-treaty side. And I think that this must have bolstered the sense of legitimacy of the Free Staters, and confirmed their determination to continue to press forward with the Free State.
Very good. Brian, can you maybe set the scene then in terms of tensions on the ground? Because it's not just looking at pro and anti-treaty sides, then you also have other communities who are also feeling under pressure in this period in Cork.
Sure. For most people on the ground, maybe the first thing to think about is the uncertainty. So we now know how the Battle for Cork goes and we know how the Civil War goes. But people on the ground in 1922 don't. So for those who vote for the treaty in the June 1922 election, there's hope that the treaty will be accepted, the provisional government will be successful and that, you know, we'll have the Irish Free State. For loyalists, on the other hand, certainly by early 1922, they've given up the ghost as far as the Union is concerned. They've put their most of their weight behind the provisional government. But their fear is where they're going to fit in this new order and the new dispensation. Their concern is, will they be allowed to exist? Some of those fears are overblown, and we now know that the worst of what they expect doesn't come to pass. But we shouldn't, you know, dismiss how genuinely they're felt at the time. So there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a power vacuum if we take the period between July 1921 and July 1922. It's not clear who's going to come out on top necessarily. So people are worried, they're concerned. They maybe fear for their place in the new state. There's also a lot of hope, I suppose, as well. So really it's a mix of responses, reactions, some positive, some negative.
And there is distrust between different communities and that's also something that's going on at this time, that these tensions and these fears and fears of sectarianism rearing its head.
Certainly. So for the loyalist community, most of them would be Protestant, although there are lots of Catholic loyalists as well. Their worry is that, you know, they might become victims of some sort of sectarian attacks, violence. And, you know, violence doesn't stop after the truce in July 1921. So they have plenty to look at if they want to, you know, think about where they stand. They can read the newspapers and they're going to read about what are being often described as sectarian attacks or attacks against the Protestant community. And, you know, we have to think about how people reading those newspapers reports are going to feel. The Church of Ireland go to Michael Collins directly and ask, you know, will we be allowed to stay here? And they're told, from the provisional government's point of view, absolutely. And the provisional government are very keen to make room for the Protestant community and to suggest that they've nothing to fear. But at the same time, there are also lots of attacks, some of them very small, very petty, some of them a lot more serious.
Very good. Sean, we had you on before when your biography of Emmett Dalton came out, and he really is this extraordinary figure. He only died in 1978, and he had this extraordinary after career where he was one of the founders of Ardmore Studios and was involved in producing movies, and you detail all of that. So when we go back in time to 1922, he is only 24 years of age, but yet he is someone with military experience, and he's in command for this daring amphibious assault.
Yes, to summarise briefly, he was born in America, and his father, who was Irish American, brought him to Ireland with his family around the turn of the century. And the father was a Redmondite, and so Dalton himself followed the call of John Redmond and joined the Royal Dublin Fusiliers at the start of the First World War. And he won the Military Cross for bravery at the Battle of the Somme. And he lied about his age. He was only about 17, I think, when he joined the army as a second lieutenant, became a captain, served in places like Palestine, and came back to Ireland then. And his younger brother had been joined the IRA as Charlie. And through Charlie, he gradually got involved with the IRA himself, and he became the director of training in the IRA General Headquarters staff. And in fact, there were some very competent men in that headquarters staff, but he was the only one with conventional military experience. And there are various events he was involved in which cemented the element of trust between himself and Collins, and there was a strong bond between them. And Collins brought him with him to the treaty talks in London as an advisor. And then, of course, at the start of the Civil War, it was Dalton who bombarded the forecourts, you know. And then he was chosen closing down for the invasion of Cork. Age only 24, as you say, leading a force of about 800 men in four ships. An extraordinary challenge for a man of such tender years.
And who's the military genius here behind the organisation? Is the idea Dalton's? Is it Michael Collins? Is there a team working on this?
I think it was a consensus between the three, Dalton, Mulcahy and Collins. Dalton, through his experience, was a very imaginative and daring commander. So I think he was fully in favour of the amphibious assault because, as we know, the overland travel had been disrupted. Approaching Cork by land would pose difficulties, and it was generally decided the best way in would be by sea. So they had four ships, and they departed on a bank holiday Monday, the 7th of August. And one of the ships, incidentally, was the Helga, which is part of Irish history, the gunboat
from 1916 that was used in Cork.
That landed troops at Yohol. And in fact, I met a man recently, and his father was on that ship, and I was eager to know more, but unfortunately he said my father died quite young and wasn't in the habit of talking about the Civil War. So the Helga landed troops at Yall. There's about 200 men landed there. There was little resistance. Then Dalton landed with the main force, about 450 men, at Passage West on the Arvonia and Lady Wicklow were the ships there. And then a fourth ship, the Alexandra, landed at Union Hall in West Cork. That had about 150 men. And of course, they also had artillery, and they had armoured Lancia lorries, and they had armoured cars, which gave them the edge over the Republicans.
Some nice texts coming in on 53106. Elizabeth and Rahini says, Patrick, have read much on these years, but in Dublin, I never knew so much was going on in Munster and Cork. It's awesome. Thank you. Well, that is something that we're trying to explore in tonight's show, and we always appreciate your texts, Elizabeth. Dahi in Cork says that the attack on Cork from the sea was not a complete surprise. The IRA had sunk block ships on the navigable channel to counter exactly this. Control of the sea by the Free State was a strategic and tactical advantage, although they wouldn't have used that language, but they used that in a situation where movement on land was going to be difficult, to say the least. John, I'll bring you in on that, because it is very interesting that although you had some experienced military leaders on the Republican side, they weren't able to control or patrol the entire coastline, and that the strategy that the National Army, the Free State Army, developed, it did catch them by surprise.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing with the Republicans was they didn't really have that big of a force. You know, they only had rifles. You know, I won't even guess how many rifles they had, but, you know, somewhere like maybe 500 to 1,000 or something. And that was basically how many soldiers they had. And they were being sucked into pretty heavy combat along this line between Limerick and Waterford. Now, they were aware of their vulnerability on the seacoast. They had put in little garrisons on all the Coast Guard stations on the Munster coast. They had also destroyed landing piers in a few different places, and they had mined pretty much all of them. So they had harbor defenses along the entire coast, which, when you think about it, that's a pretty extensive undertaking, because there are a whole lot of places you can land. You know, there are multiple landing places where you can put in kind of heavy weaponry, and, you know, in terms of the weight of armored cars, etc. And so they had a pretty it wasn't an easy choice for them, whether you concentrate on the front line up on the land thing or the sea approaches. I think probably a key was they didn't get advance notice of the National Army leaving Dublin. And so had that happened, and had they been able to communicate that, they could have maybe prepared a little bit better and been more ready for the attack that came. I mean, they had, as I said, they had small troops at all of the landing spots. They just weren't enough to stop a couple hundred folks coming on board. You're talking about maybe in some places 10 or 20 guys with rifles and, you know, facing, you know, 150 men.
Very good. Okay, well, we're going to take a very quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking about what exactly happened during the Battle for Cork. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we discuss the battle for Cork in the summer of 1922. I'm joined by Dr. Brian Hughes, Sean Boyne and Dr. John Borgonovo. Brian, before we go into the ins and outs of the battle, can we go a few months back to what happened in Bandon Valley? Because tell us about what happened there and whether it had an impact on feelings in the communities at this time.
This is one of the most contentious issues, I think, in the historiography of the entire revolutionary period. And in April 1922, which is supposedly a period of peace after the end of the War of Independence, over three nights, a number of Protestants are killed. At the end of it all, there are 13 Protestants who are dead, one member of the IRA who is dead. So we're pretty clear about what happens, the end result. The big question is, how do we explain it? Why does it happen? The other big thing that comes out is what's its impact? And its impact is huge. I think certainly for the Protestant population of Cork, it has a massive impact. There is what is described at the time as an exodus out of Cork. In the immediate months after April 1922, many of those people come back, but certainly that exodus there, it's being reported about. It gets coverage really across the country. It gets coverage in Britain. And it very much sets the scene for how, you know, Protestants in Cork are going to feel about the Free State.
So it changed their views of the Civil War in a way?
I think it potentially does, in the sense that if they'd felt maybe they're secure beforehand, this is something that makes them feel insecure, or certainly more insecure than they had done. It's something that, you know, makes people worried. It makes people afraid. Again, there are all sorts of comments being made about how this is, you know, the start of an attempt to remove Protestants altogether from Cork. Again, none of those predictions come to pass. But that doesn't mean the people on the ground didn't believe that they had something to fear. So in terms of how the Protestant community in West Cork view the Civil War, this is massive.
Very good. Sean, John, yes, please.
Yeah, just because I wrote it myself, and Andy Bielenberg wrote an article about this a couple of years ago, and I totally agree. It's the level of uncertainty that comes in. But, you know, the one aspect of the uncertainty I want to kind of introduce is the kind of class uncertainty around property, around labor relations. This is also a period of really intense militant strikes in Munster and elsewhere. But you have a pretty militant creamery strike up in the Golden Vale. You see kind of, you know, worker Soviets being declared. The big winner of the packed election in Cork City, for example, is the ITGWU candidate, Robert Day. And, you know, workers are parading with red flags. There's a, you know, Munster railway worker sees the railway for a day or two in February. So you also have pretty intense labor unrest as well. And folks are also thinking that this might be the outset of not just kind of this sectarian tensions, but also a class tensions are very much at a peak. And so that's kind of plays part of this search for stability. I think a lot of people are searching for stability. And that explains really the public support for the Free State, especially when they emerge and come south in August.
Sean, can I ask you about some of the resources that the different sides had? For example, did the Free State Army have access to air support, and was that a factor in this?
They had very limited air support. There was a guy called Charlie Russell who Dalton recruited. He was a former Royal Air Force or pilot, and he flew a mission from Waterford over Cork during the advance on Cork, I think to observe what was happening, I think, and also to give what nowadays we term close air support. There was a machine gun on board the plane, but he didn't get a chance to use the machine gun. And another purpose of his flight was to communicate with Dalton. They had no wireless communication system, so he dropped a message in a container at Passage West to tell Dalton that his communications were being received in Dublin from the Arvonia. But the Arvonia had been damaged by the Republican gunfire, and they weren't able to receive messages. And Dalton was pleading for more reinforcements. He was always discontented with the level of support he was getting from from General Headquarters in Dublin. So the message was to tell him that his messages were being received, and that the support that he was looking for, the reinforcements would arrive. But unfortunately, the container containing the message drifted into the sea and was lost, you know. So it's one of the...
Very good. Onan Kerry has texted in about the different equipment that they had. John, it's interesting the kinds of equipment that the Republicans had, because they used whatever they had to hand, including raiding the local Ford factory.
Yeah, one of their kind of famous weapons, and there's a lot of kind of oral history about it, was an armored car they called the River Lee, and they basically, you know, self-built it. They had, you know, some engineers and fitters amongst their own group. They had used kind of some of the, I think a Ford chassis from the Ford factory, and kind of stripped off as much metal as they can get. The size of the River Lee was called, someone called it the laborer cottage on wheels, or laborer's cottage, I think is what they called it, because it at least looked like a big massive box. But it gave a little bit of firepower. So they were trying to make do, and they were making a bunch more armored cars by the time the National Army landed. But you know how effective those would have been against the Rolls Royce kind of British Army models, I don't really have the technical knowledge to judge.
John, can you talk us through what actually happened? Because there was intensive shelling in Cork and Douglas and in other places. And talk us through what happened day by day. How much fighting was there?
So it's 3 days. It starts on a bank holiday, August bank holiday Monday. So, you know, real kind of sneak attack in Irish terms, Irish summer terms. The National Army leave the afternoon of the bank holiday Monday. They sail at night, and then they land in the harbor kind of around midnight, early morning hours. Now, it seems that the original plan was to sail all the way. So you know how Cork has the harbor is basically like an hourglass. There's an upper harbor and a lower harbor, and the city's in the upper harbor. The original plan seemed to be to sail all the way to the upper harbor, land probably at the Ford's factory, which had pier and kind of had some cargo facilities there, and then rush across the city and seize kind of both sides of the river. Unfortunately for the Free State, they were kind of notified that there was blocking ships. The IRA had commandeered these barges that were used for dredging, and had basically used them as a little blockade at a narrow part of the river. There were also rumors that they had mined the upper harbor, which wasn't true, but that was kind of the assumption. So a kind of a split second decision, Dalton decided, or, you know, without much warning, just Dalton decided to dock at Passage West. Now, there was a small IRA garrison at Passage West. In the meantime, there was a different vessel, the Lady Wicklow and the Arvonia were these Dublin steam packets. They were, you know, small cargo ships used for the cross-channel ferries. There was a similar-looking ship owned by the City of Cork steam packet, the SS Classic, and that had left Cork Harbor earlier in the afternoon, probably early evening. And it seems that some of the garrison thought that the ship that was approaching the dock was actually the Classic that had come back, so they didn't fire on it because they were just kind of confused what it was. And when it docked, they kind of realized they made an error, and kind of troops jumped out. So there was fighting. They were overcame and overwhelmed that little garrison with about 30 or 40 IRA guys who fled. But then there was, as Sean was mentioning, there was kind of cross-channel firing from Cove, which had pretty well-armed IRA forces there. And then IRA forces from the city kind of came down and blocked them. So there was kind of heavy fighting in that next day. And there was also a blowing up of kind of all the bridges. So the National Army was kind of stuck on this kind of peninsula. They were isolated, and they had to fight their way up towards the city. And so that the Tuesday, there was fighting kind of during the day. They'd moved into Rochestown. The heaviest fighting was on Wednesday, and that was really kind of the intense part of it. And that was when you had probably IRA reinforcements kind of came from other parts of the country. They came up from Brewery in Limerick. They came from Waterford on commandeered trains. And you probably had about 200 IRA members fighting about 300 National Army soldiers. And that's when the armored cars were deployed. That's when the National Army's artillery was deployed, its cannon, and so there was shelling going on, and it was, you know, pretty intense. And that lasted kind of for the next day, and then the third day there was some more fighting in the in Douglas Village. But about midday, the IRA decided to disengage, and then they pulled out. They pulled out from Douglas. They pulled out from the city, and the National Army landed, arrived in the city center, kind of like about 7 or 8 o'clock. So it was basically kind of a 3-day battle, and kind of 2 days of it were pretty intense.
Sean, in some ways it was the last conventional battle of the Civil War because there was more guerrilla warfare campaign after that. So this was a significant turning point in the Civil War.
Yes, it was. It was the last conventional battle of the Civil War. From then on, it's guerrilla warfare being waged by the Republican forces. And this puts Dalton under enormous pressure. Like in a straight fight, in a conventional battle, Dalton's people would have the upper edge, obviously, but it's hard for any army to cope with guerrilla warfare, who are using hit and run tactics. I should add, by the way, Dalton had some assistance going into Cork from Captain Hugh Somerville, who is the Royal Naval senior naval officer at Queenstown or Cove, as I only found out recently, actually, that Hugh Somerville consulted with Dalton and then hired a tugboat called the Hellespont to clear a dredger, the Ona Bwy, that the Republicans had placed as a block ship. And the cost of that, the hiring the tugboat, was £18, 14 shillings and 3 pence, and he sent a bill to the Cork Harbour Commissioners, who agreed to pay.
John, we're used to journalists being embedded in units in more recent times, but this was something that Emmett Dalton would have been familiar with back then as well.
Yeah, I mean, he brought we have good newspaper accounts from reporters that accompanied him. There was a photographer. We have good photographs of it. The photographer for the Daily Independent, or for the Irish Independent, came with the fleet. There was also newsreel footage of it. The kind of the information aspects. I have a PhD student who's kind of emphasizing that. Dalton also seemed to really understand this is information warfare as well as military warfare. And as Sean mentioned there, the plane, the Free State plane that kind of buzzed the city, also was dropping leaflets. So they were trying to kind of win hearts and minds, as well as push back the IRA, because they realized that the public support was going to be key to any long-term success.
Very good. We had a text in from Pat in Carlow, who wants to know where he can source tickets for our outside broadcast in Kilkenny. Well, it's in the Langton House Hotel on Sunday the 9th of June. Tickets are available at our website, newstalk.com/events. And as I say, we'd love to see as many people from Kilkenny and from further afield, because I know that people do sometimes travel for our outside broadcasts, and we always have great fun during the show and then great fun afterwards as we have a more informal chat about life and history. Sean, let's talk about some of the casualties that were involved. Do we know how many people died? Do we know about the loss of life and the impact of this on a local level?
Well, I think about 10 were killed on the Free State side, and 7 or 8, maybe more, were killed on the Republican side. Some of the names have emerged. One unusual young man on the IRA side who was killed was a Scotsman, Ian Mackenzie Kennedy, who was very popular with the Republicans. He wore a kilt, learned Irish, Pernie's mother brought him to Ireland so that he wouldn't be conscripted in the Great War. Apparently another son had been killed in the Great War and she thought he'd be safe in Ireland, and sadly he died. And when Emmett Dalton many years later was interviewed by Cathal O'Shannon for that great documentary, Emmett Dalton remembers, he paid tribute to Ian McKenzie Kennedy, saying that he was very brave, he wouldn't surrender, and he died. And Dalton says, I salute bravery wherever I see it. And then, on the other side, I'm reminded of the Saving Private Ryan film, two teenage brothers in the National Army were killed. Private Frederick McKenna, aged 18 years, and Private Gerald McKenna, aged 17 years. They had an address in Phibsborough, not far from where Dalton himself lived. And then, when I was doing research in the military archives, I was astonished to come across details of another young soldier, Private Henry Quinn, because I knew his family. And when I was growing up in North Dublin, I lived near the Broadstone area, and the family across the road from me were, across the street, were called Quinn. And I didn't realise until I read these reports that their son had been killed. It was a very tragic situation. He was wrongly identified. Apparently his face had been obliterated, possibly by a shotgun blast at close range, and they thought he was somebody else, and he himself was posted as missing. And there were these heart-rending letters from his mother seeking news of him, and eventually discovered that a man buried under a different name was in fact Private Quinn. So even though this is part of history, events like this bring it home to you in a personal way.
Very good. Okay, well, we're going to take another quick break now. When we come back, we'll try and capture some of the chaos and confusion of this period, and we look at the impact of the Battle for Cork.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Very good. Welcome back to Talking History. Elizabeth and Rahini has texted back to say she'd like the name of Sean's book on Emmett Dalton because she'd like to read more about him. Well, I will do that. And in fact, I'll give the names of all my panellists' books. We're joined by Dr. Brian Hughes, author of Defying the IRA, Intimidation, Coercion and Communities During the Irish Revolution. Sean Boyne, author of Emmett Dalton, Psalm Soldier, Irish General, Film Pioneer. And Dr. John Borgonovo, author of The Battle for Cork, July to August 1922. I'll also mention our outside broadcast in the Langton House Hotel in Kilkenny on Sunday the 9th of June. We're really looking forward to talking about the history of that great city, and we'd love you to join us. Just go to our website newstalk.com/events. Tickets are free and we always have great fun at them. Sean, talk to me about what Emmett Dalton did then in the immediate aftermath. Where was he based? Who did he meet? And what was he involved with?
Well, when he arrives in Cork, at first he sets up his headquarters in a railway carriage. But then obviously he feels this isn't good enough. And he moves into one of the best hotels in Cork, the Imperial. I think there was a kind of a psychological warfare. He was sending out the message that I'm representing the state here with all its power and its authority. And it was also a place where he could receive dignitaries, and he became tired of all the dignitaries who were calling to welcome him. Among those who welcomed him to Cork were the clergy from both the Catholic Church and the Church of Ireland, and he got a particularly warm welcome from them. And Bishop Douse was the local Church of Ireland bishop, and I think they were probably concerned too about not just about the Bandon Valley atrocity, but in March, the previous March, two Protestant teenagers had been kidnapped in Cork. One was only 15 years of age, a young chap called Parsons, and he was executed as a spy by the IRA and secretly buried. And his parents approached the bishop, among others, other people. So I think this caused concern among the Protestants, events like this. And the bishop's emissary, Canon Flood, gave a very warm welcome to Dalton and assured him of the loyal cooperation of members of the Church of Ireland. And of course, Bishop Coughlin, the Catholic bishop, was strongly anti-IRA, and he also gave a very warm welcome to Dalton. Obviously, there was no proper police force there, so he set up a temporary police force of his own, and that operated until the following November, when the new civic guard came into Cork. I think that must have been also reassuring for the Protestants, a sign that there was stability and security coming into the city, and that, you know, the abduction of teenage boys might be a thing of the past. In the meantime, he was very frustrated at the casualties being inflicted on his men. At this stage, I think there was no way back for the Republicans, and I think he probably saw these casualties as totally needless. And unfortunately, after Collins died, there was also an extra element of bitterness, I think, among the Free Staters, and you find extrajudicial, a couple of extrajudicial executions being carried out as well by the Free State forces. And of course, over in Kerry, it was far worse with Ballyseedy and so forth. He was also, Dalton was also frustrated at what he saw as the lack of support from Dublin. He was used to the great resources of the British Army. When he was in Palestine, he could travel by train, he could call into these big supply depots, get what he wanted, whereas the Free State Army had much leaner resources, and he was frustrated at the lack of transport, lack of logistics, and the lack of manpower. I think this may have been among the factors that ultimately led to his resignation.
Yeah, why do you think Emmet Dalton doesn't get the, like, he's not really a famous name in Irish history. He doesn't really get huge recognition, even though he did lead this very successful military landing during the Civil War, had that record during the Civil War, that I'm surprised he isn't more of a popular name.
It's kind of hard to explain it. I'm not really sure. For many decades, the other side were in power. Maybe they didn't want to remember somebody like Dalton would have been from the other side. I just don't know.
John, Brian, we get an insight into what was happening to civilians and what Sean was saying, and clearly this had a major impact on people in Cork, whatever their backgrounds or whatever their religious beliefs or whatever side they were on in the Civil War.
Yeah, civilians are very much expected to play their part in this. And as you say, it's often regardless of what their position might be. It's particularly the case once the war reverts back to the kind of guerrilla war that you'd seen during the War of Independence. But really throughout this whole period, civilians are expected to provide food, to provide accommodation, and also to provide transport. So one thing that's very common in this period are cars being commandeered. Cars are a really valuable resource. Bicycles as well. And this means that for civilians, there's a very genuine fear throughout this whole period of a late night knock on the door. A man with a gun shows up at the door and asks for food or accommodation or for your car or for your bike. And very often those who suffer these late night knocks on the door don't know who it is. You'll find people who claim compensation later on will say, well, the National Army, members of the National Army demanded my car, or members of the irregulars, quote unquote, demanded my car, or sometimes it's just armed men demanded my car. And very rarely the cars come back in good condition. So there's a huge economic impact in that sense, in that transport is very important to people's day-to-day lives. And these are often very poor people who are being expected to contribute financially. So I think John mentioned earlier on the idea that public support is extremely important. But also that kind of very practical support is crucial in any sort of guerrilla or irregular warfare.
John, can we talk about, go back to the chaos and confusion of this period? Because it does seem to have, it seems to be there on all sides, and it also seems to be there in terms of the fears of food shortages, and that this was quite a dramatic period in Irish history, but it was also a time of deep turmoil, and that's reflected in what people were thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't want to overemphasize the idea of the Protestant minority, because I think that we've already talked about them quite a bit. I mean, keep in mind that the Republicans, their reign wasn't really that severe. They didn't arrest Free State folks. They were commandeering property for military uses pretty relentlessly, but they weren't. It wasn't like it was a military reign of terror. That being said, people expected the city to burn down, and they expected fighting in the city. So in this period, you also have big, advertisements for fire insurance. And people were trying to take out fire insurance. Unemployment went through the roof. As you said, food shortages. I mean, the whole economy was disrupted. And this is also a really busy part of the agrarian calendar as well. So there was all that. One of the things the Republicans tried to do in order to alleviate, so Brian was talking very much about, rightfully about commandeering and that disruption. So they tried to look for other ways of funding themselves, because keep in mind that the Republicans are funding their war machine from the people. So one of the things they did was they started to seize tax revenue. So they started they occupied the customs house, and they had a couple of sympathizers in there, and they started to seize the import and excise duties. And that was really lucrative for them. They were pulling in a couple grand a day. And over the course of their time, they pulled in about 100,000 pounds. And then they also were able, they also handed over, people stopped paying rates and taxes during this period too. Because there was no government. So they started handing out, they had somebody who was in the tax office who was a member of the IRA, and they came up with tax lists, and they handed over tax bills to the big businesses in the city, which didn't go over well with the big businesses. So they were looking for ways of raising their own revenue. They had their own IRA bank accounts. So initially what you saw was a whole bunch of commandeering, and then they brought some control over it, but they just weren't really in control that long. And I think Brian alluded to it, what you really saw was a desire for peace and stability. And I think had already in Cork, there was talk about a general strike against the Civil War. That was maybe for the fall. They were talking about maybe holding a general strike the following week. And it would have been really interesting had that general strike broken out, and whether it would have spread. Because keep in mind that the National Army, the Free State Government, Provisional Government, was operating without the Dáil. The Dáil hadn't been assembled. And Collins was refusing to summon the Dáil until he militarily controlled the country. So you could have had an alternative outcome, possibly, where there would have been this, a national peace movement to stop the Civil War. And then who knows what would have happened.
Brian, that's very interesting.
Just to follow up on maybe a point John's made a little bit earlier there, and this idea of people's support, and often people's support for either side in the war was dictated by their experience of the kind of things John was talking about, seizing of tax revenue, being forced to pay levies, the kind of billeting, the commandeering that I was talking about. So, it's very easy to put people into kind of political brackets and say, well, we've loyalists and we've nationalists or Republicans. But I think, again, something John alluded to was this idea that often how people felt about the civil war that's going on around them was dictated by their own personal experience and by the financial impact that the war had on them. So people do want that return to stability. They want a return to order. And often that's because they want to be able to live, to be able to make a living, to not have these kind of issues, these economic impacts dictating their daily lives. So money is extremely important in terms of people's motivations, how they feel about what's going on around them.
Very good. Sean, let's talk about Michael Collins then and his decision to visit Cork and do his tour. Why did he do that? And what was Emmet Dalton's advice to him?
Well, Dalton had been on a previous tour of the South, but he cut it short to return to Dublin for the funeral of Arthur Griffith. And then after Dalton took Cork, he decided to resume his tour and to go down to Cork to have a rendezvous with Emma Dalton. Dalton didn't know that Collins was coming, and it was on the Sunday night of the 20th of August when Collins strides into the Imperial Hotel, and Dalton said later he was glad to see Cork, glad to see Collins, but concerned he was making the visit when conditions were very uncertain. And Collins said he was going to go on a tour of his own home territory of West Cork, and Dalton advised against it. And we have a person who was present who verified that afterwards that Dalton thought that it wasn't a good idea for Collins to go around West Cork because conditions were still very unsettled. But Collins was determined to go. And I think there was perhaps a sense of the local boy made good. He was coming back to his own territory. He had a marvellous touring car. He was in a uniform. He looked well in his uniform. And he had an escort with him. And unfortunately, as we know, on the 22nd of August at Bay na Blaa, the ambush took place.
A military escort with him.
A military escort. And Collins was killed. It's interesting, I think, that Dalton, when he engaged in the invasion of Cork, he stayed behind in the Arvonia. He didn't take part in the advance. I think he learned his lesson from the assault on Baltinglass when he was nearly killed by a sniper. And so I think he believed that a commander should stay in the background.
Very good. John, I want to end with you on the legacy of the Battle for Cork. What did it change?
Well, I think it marked the end of the conventional phase of the Civil War, this first part of the Civil War. I think it showed that the National Army was really on the ascendancy. And it really shocked the morale of the Republican forces who had fought the British Army to a standstill and the British forces to a standstill in County Cork, and then were pretty comprehensively defeated by their colleagues who primarily came from Dublin. And I think that the conflict itself was going to enter a different phase. And I think that just as people were, surprised at the outbreak of hostilities, they were probably even more shocked at the direction things would go and the steps that both sides would take to try to get their political vision across in the ensuing guerrilla phase.
Okay, well, that's, I think, a good note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts for bringing the Battle for Cork alive for us tonight. Dr. Brian Hughes, author of Defying the IRA, Sean Boyne, author of Emmett Dalton, Somme Soldier, Irish General, Film Pioneer, and Dr. John Borgonovo, author of the classic The Battle for Cork, July to August 1922. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. Before I go, I'll just give another reminder that we are going to be broadcasting live from the Langton House Hotel in Kilkenny on Sunday the 9th of June, discussing the history of Kilkenny. We're going to have music, we are going to have debate, we are going to have lots of great history with a panel of historians, writers and archaeologists. So just register for tickets, newstalk.com/events. Tickets are free, but we'd love you to sign up so we know who's coming. Okay, well, my thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together. My producer, Susan Cattle, Chris Bent on sound. Next week, we have a very good one for you. We are looking at the history of a movie as we discuss Martin Scorsese's masterpiece, Taxi Driver, and we'll be finding out about its impact on American cinema and society. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.